We have a jam-packed show coming up, and I don't have much time right now to tell you that the show is going to be an interview with Francesca Albanese and Krishnan Gurumurthy about the ceasefire, which is non-existent, followed by a review of a film, Palestine 36, is a masterpiece of the Arab revolt, and then a Somali American citizen describes being tackled and abused by ICE in Minneapolis, followed by Seth Magansinger, a senator, tells Kristi Noem in a hearing that she cannot tell the good guys from the bad guys. So first, here is Francesca Albanese with Krishnan Gurumurthy.
Hello and welcome to the forecast. Phase one of the ceasefire in Gaza is holding, but it's precarious. Hundreds of Gazans have been killed since it began. Hundreds of thousands remain homeless and displaced. The Israeli Defense Force still occupies much of the territory, and Hamas have re-established themselves in some areas. So is phase two, with its transitional authority and international peace force, looking in any real way possible? Benjamin Netanyahu says it's close, but if it is, where does that leave the rights of the Palestinians? Francesca Albanese is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. She has been an outspoken critic of Israel's actions in Gaza, accusing it of genocide. Since we last spoke, she has been sanctioned by the Trump administration and has published a new report on the complicity of much of the outside world. Welcome and thank you for coming back.
Thank you, Krishnan.
The last time we spoke, you did speak a great deal about complicity, but now you have written a more formal report
Yes.
About it. You know, the world wants to move on, is the truth, doesn't it? They want to get on with the peace process, with phase two. There isn't a great desire to go back and examine what happened in the past, but you're not going to let them move on.
No, I'm not going to let them off the hook because I understand that there is a great deal of interest in moving forward. I think that the Palestinians are the first to want to move forward. And I would be the happiest not to have to document acts of genocide on a daily basis. But the thing is that the ceasefire is not, if you allow me, is not precarious, is non-existent. You know, since the day the ceasefire was proclaimed, nearly 400 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli army in Gaza. Israel has committed over 700 violations of the ceasefire. It remains in over 50% of the Gaza Strip. It continues to demolish homes, to pulverize what remains. And what is more sadistic, to withhold aid. One quarter of what had been agreed as part of the ceasefire, the so-called ceasefire, has entered the Gaza Strip. And I really encourage everyone who's listening to us, try to Google any image of Gaza today. There are nearly 2 million of survivors, genocide survivors, war survivors, whatever you want to call them, who are literally in the storm without anything to protect them. There is no shelter, like destroyed makeshift tents, and the Gaza is flooded. There is a storm, a Byron storm, which is hitting Gaza, and these people are let to die, starving and freezing, if not killed by Israeli bombs. So where is the ceasefire? I don't know.
I mean, I suppose the argument is that it's not at the intensity that it was. The level of killing isn't as high as it was, and more aid is getting in, and there is some political progress. I mean, do you at least agree that things are better than they were at the beginning of October?
Oof, you're asking me a tough question because, you know, I mean, if we had two, four British people killed every day, would it be okay for you instead of 100? It's not okay to me because why are these people dying? Why are these people being killed? I'm telling you, because this is the genocide that continues through other means. Israel has zero intention to relinquish control of the Gaza Strip. So what has been sold to the world as the as the peace plan, which other is nothing else than a 20-point thought bubble, as Commissioner Sidoti has defined it, is a way to push the international community to have an alibi not to continue to engage with Gaza. But Israel wants to continue the expulsion of Palestinians from there because this is the last attempt, the last chance they have to regain control over Gaza. And we should also be talking of what's going on in the West Bank.
Well, what do you mean by expulsion? Because you have said Israel is continuing the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. Yeah. What do you mean by that? Who is being expelled? Where are they going? What is the ethnic cleansing beyond the killing? I accept that there is killing going on.
Yeah, there is killings, but I've said that in the pursuit of this desire of ethnically cleanse what remains of historical Palestine, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, Israel has committed acts of genocide and using the fog of war as an excuse. And now the ceasefire risks allowing Israel to continue what the harshest phase of the genocide has not allowed it to do, because the Palestinians have not left. Now, with the storms, with the freezing weather, without food, without shelter, Israel is opening the Rafah border, telling Palestinians, you can go out, but you cannot come in again. So this is, again, it's in line with the trajectory that has started in the 50s of Israel encouraging what even that minister Ben-Gvir calls voluntary migration. There is nothing voluntary. It's really one of the most sadistic and international community-backed forms of crimes that I've seen in my lifetime.
But there isn't there some political progress? I mean, there is a process now towards phase two, which is about creating a Palestinian committee with international supervision, with Palestinians involved. People are now starting to say it may actually have some representation from the Palestinian Authority, which was something that was said they said it wouldn't have before. So this is the beginning, once again, isn't it, of a Palestinian voice and Palestinian control over their own affairs?
Well,
I mean, isn't there a hopeful way to look at progress as well?
I don't want to sound like the grumpy one who's never happy about anything, because this is not the case. I'm just someone who knows the history. I mean, I've heard these arguments at the end of the first Intifada when the peace process started with the Oslo Accords. The Oslo Accords were saluted by everyone, including the Palestinians, as a stepping or a building block of enduring peace. Have you seen any day of that of peace for the Palestinians? No, because the word peace has been used to distract people from what was going on, the enduring occupation. And let me comment on the peace plan, which have been quite, together with other independent experts and human rights organizations, have been quite critical of. And for me, it's very tough, because now this plan is incorporated in a UN Security Council resolution. So I'm really, it's a dilemma, because the UN Security Council resolution is law, but this is a law that violates basic tenets of international law, because you say, yeah, but there is a government, there is a transition force. Yes, and look at them. I mean, they are headed by, and in basically the decision power is in the hands of the United States, which is has been the most significant partners of Israel in the genocide. The Palestinians are brought in as an act of tokenism. There is a violation of the International Court of Justice decision of July last year, which orders, and this is for me the roadmap to peace. It orders Israel to withdraw the troops from the entirety of the occupied Palestinian territory, Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. No mention of what's going on in the West Bank. And please, let's try to talk about that later. But also to dismantle the colonies and to stop using Palestinian resources. Had this been incorporated in the UN Security Council resolution, I would have been
optimistic. But Israeli withdrawal will come, won't it? If phase two is implemented, there will be an international stabilization force, which will also severely curtail Israel's ability to continue mounting the strikes that it has been?
I don't see that peace plan, because that peace plan refers to demilitarization and de-radicalization of the Gaza Strip and Hamas, whatever it is, whatever remains, but not of Israel, which is the state which has killed and injured nearly 200,000 people and left nearly 2 million to die.
Sorry, what do you mean? Are you suggesting Israel should be demilitarized?
I'm just posing another question. Why is the occupied Palestinian territory, which is unlawfully occupied by Israel, is to be demilitarized while there is no, this is something imposed on the Palestinians, which are the oppressed, occupied people. But there is no conditionality imposed on the unlawful occupier, which has committed crimes after crimes. Israel has just killed, and these are the numbers that are ascertained, 70,000 people. And there are up to 150,000 who are injured with life-enduring injuries. I've seen bodies chopped into pieces, Krishnan, and this is not something that can be repaired. So the state which has devastated the Gaza Strip, which continues to commit violence day in and day out against the Palestinians, including in the West Bank, where is no Hamas, there is no question and no conditionality about restraint of military force of the state. Again, it's a very disproportionate plan.
It is clearly a disproportionate plan, because it was won by military force ultimately, and you know, in the real world, we have to accept what we can take, don't we?
Krishnan, there was a genocide. How cynical it is to describe. Yes, there was military force. There was unlawful use of force
that has been ongoing for decades. This is not a situation in which
the
outside world came in and said, right, break it up, we're going to sort out the future. This was effectively a military victory by Israel, aided by the United States. And then the United States said, stop now and enter a political process.
It's more a victory of impunity and lawlessness than military victory. There has been a huge resistance inside the occupied inside occupied Gaza, is true. But the question is, what are the Palestinians supposed to do? Do the Palestinians have the right to protect themselves, to defend themselves?
Apparently
yes or
not.
No?
Apparently, according to the way the international community
international, this is why I say it's the success of lawlessness, not of military force. This is the recognition of might makes right. Again, fine, but this is not where. This is not what would lead to stable and enduring peace. This is going to lead more violence.
Do you believe that, you know, we should, as an international community, be engaging with the process? Or are you saying the process is corrupt?
Yes. No, the process should be premised upon respect for international law.
Because, you know, different countries are engaging with it. The Arab world has clearly had some success in trying to shape what the board of peace will be. It looks like Tony Blair is not going to be taking a leading role on the board of peace, at least. At the moment. So again, in terms of trying to, I accept you think this is a terrible piece, but in terms of trying to make progress, what do you think are the steps now that should happen?
I think I'm not optimistic, because 191 members of the international community of the United Nations are bending backward in order not to upset the United States and Israel with it. So it's very difficult to enforce international law while one state, the United States, calls the shot and no one reacts against it.
If the Saudi prince, MBS, is on the board of peace, where does that leave the concept of international human rights?
Why can't the Palestinians rule themselves? Is it that foreign to us, the idea that these people in 2025 can be treated as an independent people rather than a colonial entity, because this plan reproposes an anachronistic idea that the Palestinians have to be handled by someone.
So you don't believe this plan would ever lead to self-determination?
No. I'm certain because if there was an interest in accompanying Palestinians in guaranteeing that the Palestinians enjoy their self-determination, and this is key, this is why I insist, there would be an adherence, a conformity with what the International Court of Justice has already decided. The International Court of Justice, you remember, sorry, open a parenthesis. Do you remember last time I was here, we were discussing genocide and you were objecting that the International Court of Justice has not concluded that there is genocide? And I was saying, yes, but this doesn't matter because according to international law and the Genocide Convention, as long as there is a risk of genocide or incitement to genocide, something that the International Court of Justice has recognized in January 2024, then this is when the obligation to prevent kicks in. Now, we are at the phase where the International Court of Justice has already pronounced itself, saying the occupation is unlawful and member states cannot aid and assist economically, financially, militarily, strategically, politically, these states. So you see, the starting point should not be what is politically convenient to the United States, accompanied or not, supported or not by Arab states. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What matters is the realization of the right of self-determination of the Palestinian people.
And when they turn around to you and say, well, okay, but the last time there was an election, they voted for Hamas. And look where that got us. What's the answer?
I think that this is not correct. This is a brutal simplification of matters because and this is not to defend Hamas or anyone, it's just let's put the Hamas aside, because in this part of the world, the word Hamas generates such an emotional hysteria that doesn't allow to progress in the discussion. But there were no elections until 2005. And back then, the Israeli occupation had been there for many decades, oppressing and ruling through military rules the Palestinians, governing through military rules the Palestinians. So why after the elections there was no acceptance of the vote? This would not be the first time the international community didn't agree with an election. That opposition from the Western world and Israel was strategic to break through the Palestinian secular political component. And in fact, there are even Israeli commentators and former prime ministers who said that, in fact, Hamas has been used as an excuse to divert the political attention, or rather the attention, from the peace process to a security response. So Hamas has been a very convenient card that Israel has pulled to maintain the occupation.
But also, look at who
the Israelis have voted. You have someone who has Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, but even, I mean, look at the Israeli society keeping in power people who are wanted by the ICC. I mean, This is called self-determination, yes. Right? So why the Palestinians shouldn't be able to determine themselves and elect whom they want?
Right, but if you try to hold an election this year, this coming year, there aren't any political structures or parties or campaign groups or philosophies that people can unite around, are there? There's no political culture around which you can suddenly say, okay, have democracy.
Krishnamba, what do you care? I mean, why do you all of a sudden care for Palestinian internal self-determination? Can we just mind our business?
You're saying, why don't we let them determine themselves?
I'm not saying that. This is international law, and this has been the case for over 100 years.
But if you say, okay, let's deliver that instead of a long transitional peace plan, which is what is currently being proposed, is it practical?
It doesn't matter. It's legal. This is the only legal path. And you see, this is
the... practicality matters, doesn't it?
Practicalities matter when legal arguments are distorted in order to accommodate political convenience. No one cares about the governing abilities of the Palestinians. No one, because no one cares about the Palestinians for real. Otherwise, we wouldn't leave 2 million people in the abominable conditions they are today.
But I mean, and this may sound very cynical, but hasn't the last 2 years proven that for most world governments, international law is not supreme? That is not the most important thing in their minds. They believe in real politic, in workable solutions. Mm. And if that is not in line with international law, well, too bad.
To an extent, I agree with you. The last 2 years have proven that not all governments, because, excuse me, there are governments in the global majority, otherwise known as the global south, that have called out the genocide, that have started to cut ties with Israel, economic, military, and political ties. So let's reframe it. The last 2 years have demonstrated that the majority, not even the totality, otherwise we would invisibilize states like Slovenia and Spain, the majority of Western governments, primarily yours and mine, are very fine with the continuous trashing of international law. And at the same time, these 2 years have proven another thing, that, you know what, 450 millions of Europeans are not fine with it. And this is why they are protesting. They are protesting the genocide from universities to working places. And they've been protesting for over 1 year now. And the response of the so-called liberal democracies, look at these countries, is criminalizing journalists, criminalizing activists, or in Germany, beating up demonstrators day in and day out, or in France, preventing academic conferences to take place. So, you know, Gaza and Palestine today have put ourselves in front of a mirror and are telling us who we are as individuals, as societies. And frankly, look at the again, before thinking of what the Palestinians would be ruled by, look at the governments we have, who have been teaching and preaching international law and human rights worldwide until they were put on a test. We should step out of this colonial posture. And this is the other thing. For the first time, I mean, if there is one thing that this genocide has led us to that makes me be optimistic, is the awakening. For the first time, there is a global awakening of what genocide is. It didn't happen with the genocide in Rwanda. It didn't happen with the genocide in former Yugoslavia. This genocide has provoked a global outcry. And doesn't matter how hard so-called liberal governments push on their citizens to obey and look away, people don't bend, because they see the humanity of the other and their own humanity sacrificed in Gaza. And so maybe things will change also politically for us. I want to live in a system which is coherent, where international law is respected for the Israelis, for the Palestinians, for myself and for you. Is it that much to ask in 2025, Krishnan?
Well, I mean, isn't the trouble that you are then in a situation where you say, well, the law should be supreme, and it doesn't matter about whether practicalities mean it's too difficult to deliver. You get into a very purist position when there is actually a process that you can engage with, that you can try and make better. You know, are you in danger of making perfection the enemy of the good?
That's so scary.
Well, I mean, it's, I suppose,
applying
maybe it is
the
scary.
Law is
maybe
purism?
It is scary, but maybe it's also the reality of where we are.
And Krishnan, if someone breaks into your house, you call the police and the police comes and arrests you instead of the aggressor, wouldn't you be appalled and call for others to react and to protect you and to help you. this is the situation of the Palestinians. This is the situation of the Palestinians. And again, I'm not, I have no stake in this other than being a human rights expert who's been asked by the United Nations to look at what happens in occupied Palestinian territory at the worst possible moment in history for the Palestinian people. And I have been the quasi eyewitness of a genocide, documenting it day after day. And so, no, I don't think that asking for the application of basic rules of international law is purism. Actually, it's pretty basic to preserve peace and stability.
But international law has been defied in Israel for 40 years.
And maybe this is the end of it. May this be the end of it. Because Israel's propaganda doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work anymore. It keeps
on
being used.
But what makes you think this is the end of it, given where we have ended up?
I said
Where in your own analysis, we've ended up in a very pro-Israeli peace process.
Yeah, because this is where because governments are complicit. Say, I documented the level of political, military, financial, economic, diplomatic, strategic support that 62 states, to different extent, grant Israel, which is the reason why the genocide continues, on top of the fact that there are so many businesses and entities, banks, pension funds that are profiting from it.
Do you think the complicity that you have analyzed will ever be called to account? And if so, how?
If human rights lawyers did their job, oh yes.
So give me an example. I mean, you in your report, you take Britain as an example.
Yeah.
Partly because of the flights that were made over Gaza by military aircraft and the information that was handed on to them. How do you think that you describe that as complicity? How can that ever be prosecuted?
Through domestic courts or an international court. Everyone should respect the law. And this is why I think that government officials in an ideal world will have to be accountable for what they have done in supporting the genocide. Look, would you have imagined a Nuremberg trial in 1935 or 1936? Probably not. And then there was, and this was the first time that, for example, industrialists, people involved in providing the tools, the chemicals that were used in the gas chambers by the Nazis, they were brought to trial. Would you have imagined one day to have standards applicable to businesses, not so as to make sure that they would comply with international law, while the old argument was, only states have human rights obligations? No, everyone with an ounce of power is to respect international law, including businesses and multinationals, especially today where multinationals have more leverage and power than sovereign states.
And are you using Nuremberg as an example of how it can take a long time to bring international justice? Or are you, as some people will suspect, also using it to compare Israel to Nazi Germany?
No, I'm not comparing Israel to the Nazis. I'm comparing what happened after the Nazi fascist Holocaust. There was the Nuremberg tribunals, and then there were the Tokyo tribunals. But today, to what needs to happen today, the reality is different. We have an international criminal court, which can prosecute, investigate, and prosecute individuals for war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and the crime of aggression. That court is being impaired and attacked as we speak, so as to hamper justice. But still, there are national courts. And, you know, as we speak, yes, it's not that everything is grim and, it's not that everything is dark in the UK. There have been some positive developments in courts. There was an activist charged with terrorism that was acquitted recently. And again, this is why I say eventually justice might knock at the door of those who have betrayed it.
I mean, you say the ICC is under attack, and it is. with key people sanctioned by the United States. You are also sanctioned now since our last conversation. How has that affected your life?
Badly. Honestly, it has, because it has affected me, because while I do what I do as a human rights expert, who's really devoting, making huge sacrifices to serve the United Nations, at the same time, I am treated as a criminal by the United States. I've been sanctioned, which means just for doing my job, which is even a violation if I were an American citizen. It's a violation of the First Amendment.
So how does it impact you?
It impacts, there is a travel ban. I cannot travel to the US even in the exercise of my function. In fact, the last reports to the General Assembly, well, I had to present it from South Africa because I couldn't travel to the United States. But also it has, it imposes penalties on those who work with me, anyone who's a U.S. person, meaning a citizen, someone who works in the U.S., who has assets in the U.S., a U.S. resident, who engages with me, can face jail up to 20 years and penalties up to $1 million. It's huge. And the fact... And this
so what
has
does that
implications.
Mean? You can't have banking or?
No, my bank account. I mean, I've been living in the US. I gave birth in the US. And I was planning to return to the US. My daughter is an American citizen. She's US educated. She goes to the American school. Her dream is in a few years to go and study in the US. She cannot, because the moment she steps into the US, if the sanctions are not lifted, she will risk felony for having offered a present to her mama. Can you believe this? And also the implications are felt by me as a European citizen in Europe, but also in someone who lives in Tunisia.
How?
Because I cannot open a bank account anywhere, because it doesn't matter where you are. When it comes to banking, we are under US law. Why? Through the SWIFT code. The moment I do a financial transaction that requires the SWIFT code, virtually everything that is that happens internationally through international circuits, I get banned. There is a red flag. And so the sanctions on me pose a risk on the banks that open a bank account for me. They risk to incur in secondary sanctions.
And so this is
why I have to travel with cash, but it's extremely complicated because I cannot get paid.
How are you paid?
I've not been paid. I've not received a payment for work that I do other than as a special rapporteur since August this year.
Because you can't be.
I cannot be paid. Who's going to receive this money? It's extremely complicated. Also, because with the money laundering legislation, God bless it, it's impossible to transfer money. I've been offered the opportunity to open a bank account at the Cayman Island. I don't want to do that. I don't want to recur to these dodgy expedients. I want to be protected as a European who has committed no crimes.
And the United Nations has called for the sanctions to be lifted.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But how long can you, do you think you can carry on living like this?
It's a significant violation of the UN Charter, of the privileges and immunity of the United Nations that protect me as a UN expert. These sanctions must be lifted. So I do expect member states to come back to senses and to stand up with the United States persuading it to lift the sanctions. Also because it's a very dangerous precedent. Think of the chilling effect it's having on anyone who's working in the, I mean, not just in the UN, but on this issue.
Can I ask you what you think the effect of your speaking out has had on the status of UN special rapporteurs? You know, obviously, your opponents say that you are biased, that you've taken a side, that you are, you know, that you're not an impartial rapporteur. Right. You are now sanctioned as a result. Israel bans you. You're persona non grata. Do you think there has been an effect on your position that affects other people as well as you?
It might. It might, because again, the chilling effect is felt. And there are people who are extremely courageous and defiant, and they don't care. They say, I'm not going to be silenced, which is also my position. I mean, I could have, accepted to step down from this voluntary position. I mean, voluntary in the sense that it's not even paid, and say, look, this is the end of it. You lift the sanctions and I stop. I stop what I'm doing. But I decided not to do, because again, it would be even more insulting to what I'm trying to stand for and encourage others to do the same. We cannot be silenced all. We cannot be fired all. We cannot be sanctioned all. This is why this is a call for action to protect the rule of law based system that we have with so much sacrifice built. And one thing I want to tell you is that the United States has sanctioned me because it couldn't silence me. It couldn't silence the truth. And this is the thing. Over 3 years, I think that my reports have contributed, and my being so active, which is what any other predecessor would have done had they found themselves facing a genocide. But this work has created a better understanding of the systemic structural issues that do not allow Israelis and Palestinians to live in peace together or side by side.
Despite your insistence that you will stick to the law, that you will not be silenced, that history will catch up.
Inshallah.
You know, right now we are in a situation where the most powerful country in the world, the United States, supports Israel in a peace process that's, Israel is relatively pleased with. It feels there's no process of accountability right now that's going on when it comes to Netanyahu. What has the world really learned about how might and strength and military might can get you what you want?
Krishnana, the risk of sound over-optimistic, I would say that it's not a given that this brutal system will win. Look at the South Africa experience. Very different, but with significant similarities. I mean, the South Africa apartheid regime has been able to survive not just because of the violence that white South Africans were using against black South Africans, but because of the complicity of so many Western governments till the very end of the apartheid. And if you speak to the South Africans, they tell you that the last 4 years of the apartheid regime were the fiercest. People couldn't even imagine a day where there wouldn't be apartheid, meaning entrenched in the law, because of course uprooting apartheid and what it has been over centuries, like the racial segregation, it's the last part of it, but undoing the settler colonialism of 350 years of settler colonialism, of course, takes time, but it started. And people in South Africa in the last years of the apartheid could not imagine that one day that would happen. I don't think that we can predict how it's going to be based on the brutality of the system today. Because, for example, Western governments, those we have mentioned, are acting so fiercely and even to the risk of shrinking fundamental freedoms who have been the pillars of their respective democracies as a result of fear, because they feel the pressure of their own constituencies, and politics might change and people who are now in government will lose and might face justice. So it's not won, but it's, I wouldn't call defeat as of yet. And the people who stand for human rights and justice have just to persist, to keep on believing that justice is something worth standing for, because eventually it's what's going to allow them to be spared by the brutality that we are seeing today unleashed against the Palestinians and others who stand in solidarity with them.
Francesca Albanese, thank you very much indeed. And that's it for this edition of The Forecast. Until next time, bye-bye.
And that was Francesca Albanese with Krishnan Gurumurthy. Coming up next, we have a review of the movie called Palestine 36, about the 1936 Arab Revolt.
A story of a 1930s uprising against British colonialism is key to understanding Gaza today. Palestine 36 is a potent reminder that the blueprint for Israel's depraved war crimes in Gaza were laid down by a British Empire whose tyranny the Palestinians tried and failed to end. By Jonathan Cook. Anyone wondering why the British state and media, despite the latter's pretension to serve as a watchdog on power, continue to cheerlead Israel's genocidal slaughter of civilians in Gaza, will find the answers in a new film. It recounts not the current period of history, but a story from nearly 90 years ago. Palestine 36, directed by the remarkable Palestinian filmmaker Anne-Marie Jaquir, illuminates more about the events unfolding for the past 2 years in Gaza than anything you will read in a British newspaper or watch on the BBC, if, that is, you can find anything at all about Gaza in the news since Donald Trump rebranded the killing and dispossession of Palestinians as a ceasefire. And Palestine 36 does so, unusually for a Palestinian film, with a budget worthy of a Hollywood blockbuster and with a cast that includes names recognisable to Western audiences, from Jeremy Irons to Liam Cunningham. This is a major episode of British colonial history told not through British eyes, but for once through the eyes of its victims. The 36 of the title refers to 1936, when Palestinians rose up against British colonial tyranny, more usually and deceitfully referred to as a British mandate issued by the League of Nations. The problem for Palestinians was not just the systematic violence of those 3 decades of tyranny. It was that Britain's role as a supposed caretaker of Palestine, an arbiter of peace between native Palestinians and mostly Jewish immigrants, served as cover for a much more sinister project. It was British officials who ushered Jews out of Europe, where they were unwanted by racist governments, including Britain's, to implant them in Palestine. There they were actively nurtured as the foot soldiers of a coming Jewish state that was supposed to be dependent on Britain and assist in strengthening its imperial regional agenda. In effect, an overstretched British Empire hoped over time to outsource its colonial rule to a Jewish fortress state. One of Britain's top priorities was crushing an Arab nationalism sweeping an area of the Middle East known as the Levant in response to British and French colonial rule. Arab nationalism was a secular, unifying political ideology that sought to overcome the arbitrary borders imposed by the colonial powers and strengthen Arab identity in opposition to foreign occupation. It was profoundly anti-colonial, which is why Britain and France were so deeply hostile to it. The Palestinians were critically important to Arab nationalism because their homeland served as a geographical bridgehead between the powerhouses of Arab nationalism in Lebanon and Syria to the north, and Egypt to the south. For the British, the impulse for liberation in Palestine had to be snuffed out at all costs. However, the increasing brutality of British despotism simply fed an insurgency that by 1936 solidified into what Westerners term a 3-year Arab revolt and Palestinians call their very first intifada, or uprising. Later, there would be years-long, large-scale Palestinian uprisings, this time against Israel's even more repressive brand of settler colonialism that erupted in 1987 and again in 2000. The 1936-39 revolt grew so large that at its height, according to Palestinian historian Rashid Khalidi, Britain briefly had more British soldiers stationed in tiny Palestine than in the whole of India. This is the story recounted by Palestine 36, one that British schoolchildren are never taught, and one that the British media never offer as context for today's crimes in historic Palestine. Which is why Britons watching the film are likely not only to be shocked by the extent and nature of Britain's colonial violence, but to see in those savage events a premonition of what is now unfolding in Gaza. There are small sections of the Palestinian solidarity movement quick to condemn Israel's brutality towards Palestinians as something exceptional, as something peculiar to Israel and its rationalizing ideology of Zionism. Jakir's film is a potent reminder of how foolish this approach is. Israel's current colonial violence is simply a more sophisticated, more high-tech version of the techniques employed by British colonialism nearly a century ago. The Israeli military learnt from the British, quite literally. One of the main characters in Palestine 36 is the British officer Ord Wingate, who carried out night raids on Palestinian villages to terrify their inhabitants. Wingate organised punishment squads comprised of British soldiers and recently arrived Jewish militia members to conduct these raids. The training he offered to the Jewish militias in British military colonial strategy and hybrid warfare would later serve as the Israeli military's playbook. The death of Wingate in 1944 in a plane crash in Burma was lamented by David Ben-Gurion, Israel's founding father. He commented that had Wingate survived, he might have served as Israel's first military chief of staff. The film shows Wingate committing routine war crimes, using a Palestinian child as a human shield, rounding up Palestinian women and children to put them in an open-air barbed wire camp, depriving them of water in the midday heat, burning Palestinian crops, blowing up a bus of Palestinian men he had arbitrarily detained. Meanwhile, British colonial police officer Charles Tegart imported into Palestine militarised forts of a type he had earlier devised and constructed across India to put down the uprisings there. These forts would become the blueprint for Israel's series of steel and concrete walls and checkpoints that have fragmented historic Palestine and caged much of the Palestinian population into prisons, including the largest, Gaza. Watching Palestine 36, it is hard not to be reminded, as we see Palestinians richly humiliated, abused and killed by the British, supposedly to instill obedience, why each Palestinian generation has grown more radicalised and more desperate. Britain's vicious colonial repression of the three-year uprising of 1936 led ultimately to Hamas's violent one-day jailbreak on the 7th of October 2023 and Israel's genocidal colonial rampage in response. Israel's genocide will no more pacify this generation of Palestinians than Wingate's crushing of the Arab revolt did to an earlier generation. It will simply deepen the wounds and a collective will to resist. Importantly, the film also grapples with, if more obliquely, Britain's contribution to an ideological zealotry usually attributed to Israel. Wingate's fervent subjugation of the Palestinian people and his view of them as little more than animals, as well as his passionate attachment to the Jewish people, were rooted in the ideology of Zionism. All too often overlooked is the fact that Zionism long predates its modern-day incarnation as Jewish nationalism. Wingate followed in a long tradition of influential European Christian Zionists who believed that biblical prophecy would be advanced by restoring the Jewish people to their ancient homeland. Only then, in a supposed end times, would the stage be set for Christ to return and establish his kingdom on earth. Lord Balfour, he of the 1917 Balfour Declaration that promised a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, was another prominent British Christian Zionist. Today, such views are shared by many tens of millions of Christian evangelicals, who are the support base for US President Donald Trump. The Palestinian people, many of whom genetic studies suggest are descended from the ancient Canaanites living in the region thousands of years ago and who subsequently converted to Christianity and Islam, were viewed by Christian Zionists like Wingate as little more than an obstacle to the realization of divine prophecy. If they would not obey God's will by clearing themselves out of their own homeland to make way for the Jewish people, then they would have to be forced to do so. The Zionism of Israelis, as poll after poll shows, has led them in a similar racist direction to Wingate. Large numbers support ethnic cleansing and the genocide of Palestinians. Social media posts by Israeli soldiers openly revel in their depraved treatment of Gaza's people. which brings us back to the present day. Film reviews in the British press of Palestine 36 have been at best lukewarm. Even the supposedly liberal Guardian damns it as heartfelt, as if mollifying a child over a second-rate school essay. That should not surprise us. The British establishment, just like the US one that took on the mantle of global policeman from Britain after the Second World War, still treats Arab nationalism as a threat. It still views Israel as a vital colonial outpost. It still regards Palestine as a testing ground for techniques of surveillance and counterinsurgency. It still views the Palestinians as not fully human. Which is why British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, sounding like a modern version of Wingate, reinvented as a politician, was unabashed in defending Israel's decision to deprive the people of Gaza, including its 1 million children, of food, water and power. That is, to starve them in violation of the fundamentals of international law. It is why Starmer and the British establishment keep shipping arms to Israel and supplying it with the intelligence it has been using to target civilians. It is why Starmer welcomed to Downing Street Israel's president, Isaac Herzog, who rationalised the genocide by stating there were no uninvolved civilians. It's why the British Army is still training Israeli military officers in the UK, just as Wingate did with their predecessors. And it is why British officers still head to Israel to learn from its genocidal military. It is why Britain still offers Israel diplomatic protection, and why it has threatened the International Criminal Court for seeking to hold Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to account for committing crimes against humanity. And it is why Starmer and his government have changed the definition of terrorism to criminalise Britons who express opposition to the genocide in Gaza. The truth is, we cannot look to our government, schools or our media to educate us about British colonial history, whether in Palestine or in any of the other places around the globe that Britain has tyrannised. Instead, we must start listening to the victims of our violence if we are ever to understand not just the past, but the present too.
Next, we're going to shift gears and talk about the fascism developing in the United States of America. A Somali-American citizen describes being tackled and abused by ICE in Minneapolis on December 10th.
All I did was step outside as a Somali-American, and I just got chased by a masked person. The agent didn't, at one point, he didn't identify himself. He didn't say, ICE, stop. Like, I felt like I was getting assaulted. I was getting kidnapped, and that's exactly what it was. And the way they were treating me, it was inhumane. They dragged me across the road. They slammed me to the ground, choked me. That was uncalled for. There's also more videos of someone came out. They had a copy of my passport. And I told the agent, he has my passport copy. And he said, we don't care, we're still taking you in. And they kept me for 2 hours. And if this is what's happening to a U.S. American citizen on camera, imagine what could happen to your loved ones when there's no one around to witness what they're doing.
I apologize that this happened to you in my city, with people wearing vests that say police. That's embarrassing. But what really gets me is that this is just one story today.
But what happened to me cannot stay quiet. What happened to me was unjust, uncalled for. I was simply on my lunch break. I literally went downstairs from my building. I wasn't even outside for mere seconds before I seen a masked person running at me full speed. He tackled me, pushed me inside the restaurant, like as you can see in the video. I told him I'm a U.S. citizen, what is going on? He didn't seem to care. He dragged me outside through the snow while I was handcuffed, restrained, helpless, and he pushed me to the ground, and he put me in a chokehold. That was very uncalled for. I thought I got really hurt. And after that, they put me inside the vehicle. And they asked me, we have to verify if you're a U.S. citizen, because I believe you're an illegal citizen because you ran from me. But as you can see in the videos that will be released, I'm simply just standing still. I asked them, okay. They said, let me take a picture of you. to scan your face to see if you're a U.S. citizen. I declined because how will a picture prove I'm a U.S. citizen? I told him I have my passport. It's in my phone. Can I open it and show you? He declined. I told him, can I give you my name and my date of birth? He declined because they turned off my phone. They turned off my location. You don't know where you're at. So I asked them, can you take me back to where you picked me up from? They said, no, you have to walk in the snow. Like, they were being serious. I asked three times. They said, no, you're walking. But eventually, my parents came and picked me up. And, yeah, all I did was step outside as a Somali American, and I just got chased by a masked person. The agent then, at one point, he didn't identify himself. He didn't say, ICE, stop. Like, I felt like I was getting assaulted. I was getting kidnapped, and that's exactly what it was. And the way they were treating me, it was inhumane. They dragged me across the road. They slammed me to the ground, choked me. That was uncalled for. There's also more videos of someone came out. They had a copy of my passport. And I told the agent, he has my passport copy.
And finally, today we will hear Representative Seth Magaziner from Rhode Island.
You've already heard the story of Lance Corporal Alejandro Barranco, the United States Marine veteran who is behind you, who also has two brothers who are United States Marines. Will you thank Lance Corporal Barranco for his service?
Thank you.
His father, Narcisco Barranco, is a landscaper in California who has lived peacefully in our country for 30 years and has no criminal record. Last spring, while he was mowing the lawn at an IHOP, ICE agents tackled him in the street and imprisoned him for weeks. A peaceful, hardworking man who raised three sons to be United States Marines. We need men of that character in this country. Again, as Secretary, you have broad discretion. Will you consider Lance Corporal Barranco's father for parole in place to stay in our country, owing to the fact that he has contributed to our country by raising three United States Marines?
This is an opportunity to remind everybody that every person that's in this country illegally has an opportunity to voluntarily go home and come back the right way.
He raised three United States Marines.
We will facilitate that.
He has been living here peacefully, doing his job for 30 years. You have discretion. You are choosing not to use it. Madam Secretary, you promised America that you would go after the worst of the worst. But these people are not the worst of the worst. A Purple Heart recipient, a military spouse, the father of three Marines. And it's not just veterans and military families. You are locking up and deporting children with cancer, mothers with babies in the NICU, United States citizens. There are many problems with your leadership, but the biggest problem is this. You don't seem to know how to tell the difference between the good guys and the bad guys. Go after the bad guys. Go after the terrorists. Do not go after veterans, Marines, children.
Gentlemen's time has expired.
I yield back.
I now recognize.
And that was Representative Seth Magaziner from Rhode Island.